This episode is brought to you in part by The Table Podcast from the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary. I'm Daryl Bach, one of the hosts, and I invite you to join us as we discuss issues of God and culture, which includes anything and everything. Listen on your podcast app or at dts.edu/thetable.
This episode of Quick to Listen is brought to you in part by Classic Christian Thinkers, the new book by author and theologian Kenneth Samples. It highlights the lives of some of Christianity's greatest historical figures. Get your copy today by visiting www.reasons.org/quick-to-listen.
You're listening to Quick to Listen. Each week we go beyond hashtags and hot takes to discuss a major cultural event. This week on the show, we will be talking about Beth Moore and the Southern Baptist Convention. I'm Morgan Lee, digital media producer here at Christianity Today. I'm with Mark Galley, our editor-in-chief.
Hello, Morgan.
We just came back from the South.
You from Savannah and me from New Orleans, so there you go.
Yeah, and right now we are actually talking to someone who is currently in Birmingham. Who are we speaking with?
We're speaking with Sarah Pulliam Bailey. She's a reporter for The Washington Post. She covers how faith intersects with everything, including politics, culture, and education, issues such as same-sex marriage, poverty, abortion, and the environment. Her real claim to fame, however, is the year she worked as a reporter and editor for Christianity Today. And during that stint, she actually stayed in my home when she came. She worked off-site, and she stayed in our upstairs third bedroom. We have a plaque above it now. Sarah Pulliam Bailey.
Slept here.
Reporter for Washington Post. Slept
here.
You're going to have to come and see it. And then the other thing, I've said this to many people, Sarah, but I think I need to say it to you now, how much you annoyed me when you stayed with me. So we'd have dinner after work, and then Sarah and I would go to the living room and whip out our laptops and start working, and it's 8 o'clock, and Sarah's still working, so I have to work because I'm one of her bosses, you know? Then it's 9 o'clock, she's still working, I have to. Finally, I gave up. I go to bed and just say, I'm not a very good journalist, I guess. Wake up the next morning, and Sarah's posted a news story at 11:30 that night. So there you go. That's who we're dealing with here, a fanatical journalist and a very good one at that.
No, I am no longer a workaholic. I'm happy to tell you.
Oh, well, that is a good thing.
Oh, yes. Mark rubbed off on you, Sarah. Yes. So cool. But however, you are speaking with us from Birmingham, as we mentioned. What's going on there?
Yeah, so I'm at the Southern Baptist Convention's annual meeting. There are about 8,000 people here for the meeting. They're talking about all kinds of things from race to women to sex abuse to missions and evangelism. And I'm just here to kind of be a fly on the wall.
Wonderful. All right. Well, that's pretty cool.
I assume you'll be reporting on it. You are reporting on it daily, or how's that working?
Yes. Yeah, I've been doing pieces, and I'll keep doing a piece here and there about whatever they vote on.
Great.
All right. Well, let us get into our topic. As Beth Moore walks onto the convention center stage, the crowd erupts into screams and cheers. Several snap pictures with their cameras and cell phones. It's the largest crowd the Springfield, Illinois venue has hosted, topping Elton John's appearance over a decade ago. More than 8,000 women, from teenagers to senior citizens, have traveled from 30 states and shelled out $60 each to watch Moore open her Bible live and in person. Anybody just need a fresh dose of Jesus? Moore yells. The crowd roars back. So began Sarah Pulliam Bailey's cover story for us at CT on Beth Moore in 2010. And actually, you probably realized it was 2010 once I said several snap pictures with their cameras and cell phones.
There you go.
Yeah.
At that time, already some 666,000 had attended Moore's Living Proof live conferences, and millions had read her books. Her popularity as a Bible teacher has only grown since then. As the author of the cover story, Sarah put it, her stories about her big hair and self-tanner keep her audience in stitches, but also reveal her unmistakable rootedness in Southern Baptist culture. But her call to study the Bible seriously, as well as dramatic stories from her own life, sexual abuse as a child, a recent hysterectomy, giving her adopted son back to his birth mother, have earned Moore a following well beyond Baptist and Southern communities. In recent years, Moore has also begun speaking out on politics, sexual abuse and misogyny that she's experienced in the church. A recent profile for her in The Atlantic had two headlines: the tiny blonde Bible teacher taking on the evangelical political machine, and Beth Moore, the evangelical superstar, taking on Trump. Through her preferred medium of choice, Moore tweeted last month what she called the most disturbing, terrifying thing I'd ever seen. So she said in 2016, she was able to confront for the first time the abuses and misuses of power she had seen and experienced in the Southern Baptist denomination. Moore tweeted that she was especially concerned that, as she put it, the shepherds were, quote, guarding other shepherds instead of guarding the sheep. Moore ended her tweet thread by affirming her desire to continue to serve in the SBC, which she said she had been doing since she was 12, Advocation Bible School. She tweeted, I will serve it, and this is how I am serving it right now. At the beginning of the month, Moore provoked another controversy with some Southern Baptist leaders when discussing how she would be preaching at an upcoming church. Southern Baptists generally frown on women preaching in churches. And this week on Quick to Listen, we wanted to discuss how Beth Moore came to hold the platform that she does, when she began to speak out on more controversial topics, and what this means for the communities that she's a part of. All right, so we gave a little bit of a summary of stuff, but there's obviously some stuff that we really want to delve into. And Mark, I thought today for our Quick to Listen, rather than just pick a particular tweet to react to, let's maybe talk about how you've experienced Beth Moore, especially as she's become a little bit more vocal on politics, sexual abuse, and misogyny in the past couple of years.
Yeah. I first became acquainted with her when I discovered that her videos were being used at an African-American Bible study that my foster son's future mother-in-law was hosting. Mm. And it was a video series that was being watched by a group of upper-middle-class Episcopalian women in the western suburbs. And I thought, who is this person that can appeal to both these groups? Mm. I was pretty impressed. She did make allusions early on for many years to her sexual abuse as a young woman, but she didn't spend a lot of focus there. So what I'm hearing, okay, if I can play amateur psychologist and therapist, is her coming to grips with this and the internal anger and even rage that has been, in a sense, probably in some sense, fueling her ministry for many years. And I think that's probably a healthy thing. She does, you know, from a perspective of a journalist, I think she overplays her hand sometime, but one can understand if she's been abused and ignored for decades about this thing, why she would be speaking out so forcefully. So I admire her courage and her willingness to face and do it.
So I personally did some Beth Moore Bible studies growing up, and I would say she was my first introduction to, I don't know what to call it, like just Texas womanhood. I don't know. I did not grow up with a lot of people who wore that much makeup and did their hair in that particular way. And we'd watch her videos, and I really loved everything that she had to say, even if culturally it didn't always make sense to me. But it's really been fascinating to watch her find her voice. I think one of the ways that has been uniquely fascinating is that most of the people that we look at as like the names or personalities, maybe less so in our movement, but in movements in general, are often like really young people. And it's not always that someone in their 60s is the one that's captivating everyone, especially in the ways that she's doing it, which is like hanging out on Twitter, which, you know, you as someone who doesn't like Twitter.
Mark, she's pointing to me, everybody.
Yes, and not Sarah.
And rolling her eyebrows.
Okay.
And looking down on me.
That is literally not what I'm doing. But I'm just saying, Mark,
I'm not like saying
you're not holding court on Twitter all
the
time.
I'm not.
And it's just been interesting to kind of watch her do that. And also for her to kind of build a community around this particular, it's not just sex abuse, but it is for a lot of Christians who really don't see themselves as being cheerleaders of Trump, for instance. This is some of the things that she's been vocal about, even if not always naming the president, but provided space for those Christians, I think, who would still consider themselves relatively conservative in many ways, but at the same time wanting someone to kind of criticize the president and what that administration might stand for. And I think she's kind of been the de facto leader of that. All right, Sarah, we will get into all the stuff that we have talked about, Mark and I have addressed in the past couple minutes, hopefully through these questions that we have for you. But I guess my first question for you is just, how did you first hear about Beth Moore?
So my mom was a fan of Beth Moore, and she enjoyed her Bible studies. And then when I was living in Green Bay, Wisconsin, when I wrote that cover story for Christianity Today. And my pastor's wife at my church said that if she did a Bible study for women that was not a Beth Moore Bible study, it was super hard to get them to come because everyone was just such a fan of Beth Moore. She just has this like personality and force and charisma that really resonates with people, that really touches, especially like an older generation of women. So that's when I figured like there's something here. She's the most popular Bible teacher in the country. She's, you know, probably one of the most famous Southern Baptists in the country. And she just has an amazing following. Also, I did a cover story for Christianity Today called 50 Women to Watch. And ahead of doing that story, I polled maybe over 100 evangelical leaders and said, who are the women that you're watching? And Beth Moore was by far and away the most named person in that sort of unofficial, you know, non-scientific survey. But she's definitely one of the most visible evangelical women in the country.
Why do you think that Beth Moore has resonated so much with evangelical women?
I think she does a good job of weaving back and forth between Bible and her personal narrative and stories and connecting with women on really emotional issues. I remember, you know, women just weeping over a story she told about helping a woman through breast cancer. And she just has a way of getting at those harder issues or harder experiences. You mentioned, you know, the adoption issue that she went through, her hysterectomy, her sex abuse. Like, she's willing to talk about her two girls. She's willing to kind of go there in a way that I think you might not hear from the pulpit. So I think it resonates. I think it's a lot of women see it as a really helpful supplement in addition to the Sunday morning preaching that they get. They get this sort of extra Bible teaching from Beth Moore.
As someone who did her Bible studies growing up, I just think it's interesting too. Sometimes I've seen conversations where people start to like dissect, like, what do women's Bible studies books look like? And at least the Bible study books that I did of hers, they seem to be very like thematic based. Like, I never saw a picture of Beth Moore on the cover being like, this is Beth Moore's Bible study. But instead it was something that was like really reminding you of the scripture that you were about to like work through. And she always took the Bible studies themselves like extremely seriously. Like, I remember just doing them and they felt extremely robust. You were really working through a lot of different parts of the Bible when you were doing them. And I felt like she was someone who was like a friend that was challenging you along the way. They never really felt to me like they were pandering at all, in a way that I know that some women have like felt uncomfortable about the ways that other parts of the evangelical world have pandered to them.
And I would say the emotional resonance just doesn't work for women. I remember I interviewed her once at what was the name of that big book conference that we used to have that don't have it anymore? Whatever it
CBD?
Was. CBD, yeah, exactly. So I'm talking to her, interviewing her, and she starts to tell this story about one of her boys. And, you know, I'm just starting to get kind of emotionally moved by it, but I'm supposed to be the objective journalist in this room who is not supposed to be moved in this way. But just the way she just tells the story one-on-one is even emotionally engaging. So she's a very, very charismatic figure, for sure.
So we talked about this a little bit, but I'm wondering, Sarah, Mark had mentioned that she like talks about the fact that sexual abuse had been in her past, but she hadn't really, there's never been a point where she's really gotten into it more deeply. But to what extent has that changed in recent years?
So she was on a panel last night at the Southern Baptist Convention on sex abuse. And she said last night that she talked about this from the very beginning of her ministry. She included it in her first book. And so she always sort of mentions it kind of in passing. She never goes into detail. You know, she's very vague about it. She says that's for the protection of family members. But she somehow like weaves it back into her bigger message about Jesus and about the Bible. And but I think it's for a lot of women, it has been such a connecting point. Like, wow, she's been through so much, and yet she's here teaching, you know, fiercely or vibrantly or charismatically about the Bible. And I think it's given her a lot of sort of credibility in a sense, like I said, she's been through this really difficult trauma and it yet is still able to address and help other people. I think she has never been seen as sort of a sex abuse advocate in the way that, like, in the Catholic sex abuse scandal, we have seen a lot of survivors come out and become advocates and have really worked on kind of a legal front and have pushed Catholic leaders to address the issue. And Beth Moore more recently has sort of become one of those. And in the past, she was seen as, I would have seen her as more of this like sweet Bible teacher who doesn't really dive into politics very much. Right. But that, a lot of that changed. And as you alluded to earlier, around 2016, around the presidential election, Donald Trump, the Access of Hollywood video, where he bragged about sexual assault, that is when she sort of became this like lightning rod on Twitter. She became pretty like forcefully vocal about experiencing misogyny and sexism. And since then, she's just emerged as this like voice on these issues. And so that's what kind of got the ball rolling for how she has become a more visible presence, more than just like, oh, she's a Bible teacher.
Do you know if she was on Twitter prior to 2016?
Yeah, I think she was, but I think it was sort of part of her bigger social media platform. Like, I know she blogged. When I did that story in 2010, she was doing blogs, but they were not, I don't remember many of them really, you know, taking off in any significant way.
Yeah, so 2016, she's said multiple times, was kind of the turning point for her. Has she gone into any more depth about what exactly that was that snapped or changed?
A little bit. She's talked, that you mentioned the Atlantic profile a couple of months ago, and she talked about how it was just kind of a turning point. She wrote a blog post last year about the misogyny that she's experienced from evangelical leaders. And I think the Me Too movement, I don't know if she really like was involved in that movement or would have attached herself to that. But I think in the sort of larger conversation about women and abuse and harassment, she's really like taken that and directed it at the church.
So we got into the fact that she provoked another controversy kind of recently on the subject of women preaching. But I'm wondering if we can go back before this kind of stuff that's happened on Twitter. Have there been tensions in the SBC with Beth Moore before these more recent tweets and statements?
I think kind of, in the sense that like there are always fringy people who are, you know, concerned or wondering. She's spoken at a popular conference called the Passion Conference. And so, you know, there have been questions, can a woman teach a man? You know, should she be in these sort of preaching roles? She's preached in the past, but it hasn't been the lightning rod that it became fairly recently. And I think what happened was somebody tweeted at her and this woman said, I'm preaching at my church. And Beth Moore responded to her and said, I'm doing Mother's Day services too. She didn't use the word preaching, but everyone sort of got up in arms over, like, should a woman preach during the Sunday sermon slot where men in the Southern Baptist Convention traditionally preach? So you won't see women pastors in the Southern Baptist Convention, but there are questions over, should a woman sort of teach a Sunday school class? Should they be worship ministers? What does it mean for women to have authority over men? And she sort of like reignited this longstanding debate in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, early on, she was criticized because men were showing up at her women's conferences because they wanted to listen to her. And she just said, you know, I'm not going to turn anyone away who shows up. And if they want to come and listen, that's their business. So that's how she handled it early on. But now she's obviously taking, especially with the Passion Conference, she's taking a more specific role in teaching and preaching men. So,
Sarah, I'm curious, when do you first remember seeing something that Beth Moore did or said that surprised you?
I think it was the after Access Hollywood Donald Trump video. And I don't remember the specific tweet, but I just was like, oh my goodness. Especially in light of, at that moment, there were a lot of evangelical leaders who were backing Trump, saying, you know, this is locker room talk. His evangelical advisors were sort of willing to overlook it or suggested kind of it wasn't a big deal. But Beth Moore was one of the most vocal, I think, to sort of and quick to say this is not okay. And she carries a lot of weight. And I think she's risking something. So she's one of, I think, the most popular author for Lifeway, which is Southern Baptist Convention's publishing arm. She's their most popular author, and she's losing in book sales. They won't say how much, but it gives you an indication of the costs that she's had to incur in sort of the speaking out that she's done.
I know the Southern Baptists just came out with their report on sexual abuse and pastors. When did they start looking into that, and what effect has Beth Moore speaking out played in that, in making that report move along and, well, get started, move along, and finish?
My understanding is that the Southern Baptist leaders began looking into it last year, maybe a bit before this time, last spring. There were a couple of things that kind of flared up, including some allegations of rape at a Southern Baptist seminary, and that got kind of flared up the issue, and they brought it to the annual meeting in Dallas last year. And there, Beth Moore was on a panel addressing abuse there. So I think she was one of many voices sort of, you know, being outspoken on it and being willing. But I don't think she was like the driving factor per se. J.D. Greer, the new president of the Southern Baptist Convention, decided to make it a priority last year. And he had started getting the ball rolling and had put together an advisory board or committee or something like that. And they had been working all year long on this report. And then earlier this year in February, the Houston Chronicle dropped a pretty big story detailing just how widespread the sexual abuse scandal had gotten. Hundreds, I think 700 victims. They listed, you know, 200 leaders, Southern Baptists, you know, whether staff, volunteers, that kind of thing, perpetrators. So those were kind of moments along the way that have really propelled the Southern Baptist Convention to wrestle with this issue. But Beth Moore has become one of the, she you know, she's just such a big name. She is,
yeah, exactly.
She brings
right.
credibility to the issue. So it hasn't been just her, but she's become like kind of a lightning rod within the issue.
Has she commented on the new report?
I don't think like the specific report. I think she just in general has been encouraged to see that. Like last night she said she was glad to see it on like something on paper. So I think she's like, this is, you know, we're finally talking about this. We're finally like acknowledging it. We are like formalizing it. So she did seem encouraged just generally.
Yeah, I just thought I would also acknowledge the fact that our colleague Kate Shelmet did a piece on that's called, in the print issue at least, Holy Rumblings, and that looks at women who are basically challenging Southern Baptists when it comes to ministry abuse. And Beth Moore is one of the people in there, but there's 9 other women in here, who some of them who are survivors themselves, some of them who are not, but all of them who have advocated and pressed for reform in this particular area.
I don't know that you've had a chance to read the report yet, Sarah, but our summary of it strikes me that they're pretty, Southern Baptists are pretty hard on themselves in this report.
I mean, can you be hard on yourself when it comes to sex abuse? Like, I don't know. Like, I think they lay out the facts. I think there's something to be said about expectations from either the victims or survivors or leaders. Like, what are your expectations in terms of, you know, do you think this is an issue? A lot of the victims are like not surprised at all, and they are expecting a lot of action this week. And if you're a leader, it may be surprising or maybe overwhelming to see it documented in such detail. So I think the expectations really kind of fuel the response.
Yeah, our title is Report: How Southern Baptists Failed to Care About Abuse. Mm-hmm. SBC releases abuse study condemning past practices and recommending new protections. Which strikes me now, if that in fact is a fair summary of what the report does, sounds like a better immediate response than many denominational leaders who soft pedal it. Their first report is to soft pedal it, and it's only the second or third report that they get more honest and frank about it. But
to give you some context, there's a woman named Krista Brown who's been advocating for years for a database to be created for registered sex abuse offenders, and that has failed in motions in the past, and they're not considering that this time around. Maybe they will consider it in the future, but if that gives you an indication, like, women have come forward before, and I don't know that they ignored it per se, but like, this is the first time that they're really collectively, as a like leader after leader after leader in these panels, are saying like, we have to do something about sex abuse. This is an issue. This is an issue. This is an issue. But for someone like Krista, she would say, well, I've been telling you that for years.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was interesting. Was it last year that Al Mohler kind of came around and just was thoroughly, thoroughly disgusted with what he was hearing and learning about as well? So I think there has been a sea change in the Southern Baptist denomination on this. That would be fair to say?
So the it depends on how they vote on these sort of like action items, right? They're considering amending their constitution. They're considering some depending on how you see it, some changes. And so is that just a start of a longer process that they will entail, or are they going to, you know, do something to make a nod to it? It again, it's sort of about your expectations. And, you know, I've heard a really mixed bag from the survivors.
This episode is brought to you by Church Salary. Coming up with a reasonable salary range for church staff has never been easy. There are so many details to consider before setting compensation for church staff, and you're probably asking yourself questions like, are we paying too little or too much? What benefits do we offer employees? What's a reasonable housing allowance? Church Salary believes that offering competitive and fair compensation helps keep people in ministry. Using the expansive church-specific compensation database and powerful salary calculator tool, you can also make better compensation decisions so your staff can focus on their ministries. Start with Church Salary's annual membership today to run unlimited customized reports and get access to our member-only content. Ready to start making better compensation decisions? Get started at churchsalary.com.
Life is unpredictable. I think all of us learn that. Sometimes we learn it in good ways. Sometimes we learn it in really hard ways. You're valuable to Christianity Today, and we want you to be prepared and protected. And one of the ways that that can happen is by having a will and getting a will together for your family and to care for your loved ones. If you've already set up your will and other important estate planning documents, that's great. But if you haven't, Christianity Today has partnered with Epic Will to easily and affordably walk you through the whole process of creating a legally binding and state-specific will in as little as 10 minutes. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones to take this vital step, and you can get started today by visiting morect.com/will. That's more with just one O, ct.com/will. And for a limited time, you can get 10% off. That's morect.com/will.
Well, okay. I think one of the big things that's up for grabs, that a lot of people are paying attention to, is the part about disfellowshipping churches over these things. And for people who aren't super familiar with the Southern Baptist Convention, one of the things that makes this denomination unique is that congregations have a lot of autonomy in ways that is not true in other denominations. And so this is both kind of with regards to how these cases were often handled, where churches were not necessarily, I don't know, Sarah, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know that there was some sort of larger denominational protocol, but in one of the sections of this report, when they say we recognize failures have occurred in many areas, one of the ways that they mentioned specifically is using church autonomy improperly to avoid taking appropriate action. And
yes,
so
I've heard that over and over again.
Yeah. I just was going to say, because that to me kind of is one of the things that is really kind of persnickety, in the sense that it gets at the heart of what it means to be Southern Baptist for many people, right? And what it means to relate to the head of the denomination. I don't know. When I've been reading through the different reports this year, when people are talking about the database, I remember reading complaints from some of the leaders that, like, we specifically don't give the denomination that much power to do all these things. And basically, like, why do we want, we don't want that much oversight. Like, that's literally the point of being Southern Baptist in many ways.
The point that I heard from a survivor was, like, you know, Southern Baptists are able to cooperate on all sorts of things, like missions and budgets and buying insurance. And, you know, why can't they cooperate on something like this? But yes, I think you struck at the heart of the question for them when it comes to church polity.
And that's true of every denomination. It has its own unique polity. So, for example, in the Catholic Church, to take the other end of church polity, they are working very hard to eradicate, especially child abuse in their world. But they do have to do that in the context of their actual structure, in a way that will actually preserve the great things about the structure while also protecting victims. And that would be true everything from the Roman Catholic to Presbyterian to Methodist to Baptist.
Yeah, the Catholic bishops are actually meeting in Baltimore this week to discuss sex abuse policy. Pope Francis has recently put into place official Vatican policy on this. These are the two largest, the Catholic and Southern Baptist conventions are the largest religious denominations in the country. So, and they're both trying to tackle this issue head on this week.
And they both have complete, almost diametrically opposed ideas of what it means to be a church. It'll be interesting to see how they each, neither of them are going to solve it this week, but it'll be interesting as it evolves how they end up addressing this, because I think they're both convinced it needs to be addressed, but they are trying to juggle a lot of balls in the air at the same time. So we'll see.
I want to go back to Beth Moore for a second. One of the issues that we've looked at CT in the past couple of years is the issue of women and institutional support, or lack of institutional support, and how that shapes their ministry. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Living Proof Ministries is basically Beth Moore. And in many extent, she's been able to gain the platform that she is because she created her own place to do so, which is something that we've kind of seen consistently, if I'm correct. And I only say that in that, like, I'm not aware of any other women who are currently leading any other Southern Baptist institutions, including seminaries, but also stuff like their big publishing house, Lifeway, or even something like Lifeway Research, which is one of their big data collecting organizations. Is that fair to say that she also occupies this unique space because women have almost been shut out of every way they could come up through some of the more traditional institutions?
It is interesting. I've made a little bit of the unofficial contrast to the Catholic Church because they have a similar sort of complementarian view. You don't have women priests, but they have women leaders at their Catholic Health Association. They have women, you know, nuns mm-hmm. running hospitals and mm-hmm. Educational institutions. Whereas I think for complementarian evangelical women, it has been difficult to go through official structures to become leaders, but they've been very entrepreneurial, like Beth Moore, in creating their own worlds almost.
Given that she, because I guess she's the leader of her own ministry in many ways, and given that she doesn't necessarily have an agenda to stick through, I just think again of, like, if you're the head of a seminary, for instance, there's things that you will say as being the head of the seminary. How do you think that she will continue to play a role in terms of determining the conversation and priorities of her fellow Southern Baptists?
I think that's a good question. She seems really strategic in thinking about when to speak on what. And, you know, I think she, even though a lot of the attention was paid to her this past week, she ended up deflecting a lot of attention onto others. I think that's part of her goal is, okay, focus on me for a hot second, and then I'm going to tell you about another person. You know, in last night's panel, she was sitting next to another abuse survivor who was abused in Birmingham, you know, who doesn't, you know, have a name that we would all know. But Beth Moore just kept, you know, nodding to her and kept, you know, sort of almost passing her mantle to this other woman. And so I think we might continue to see that. She's also fairly recently addressed racial reconciliation issues, and I've been curious if that will come up in the future. I don't know when or how. I don't know if she would, you know, address immigration since she lives in Texas. So I don't know. Like, I think that's something I'll be watching in the coming years.
So beyond Southern Baptists, who does Beth Moore represent and what communities is she important to?
I think a lot of evangelical women look to her for shaping their theological views, for understanding how to study the Bible, but then also just in general, like she's funny and she's charismatic and quick. She's just, I mean, last night after this panel, this was a panel of like four or five individuals, and the women just like these young 20-something women just flocked to her and just waited in line for like an hour to hug her and to take photos of her. She doesn't have just Southern Baptist fans. It goes stretches far beyond that. And if she were to somehow shift in her views, like it would be a big deal. So I think, you know, she has a big voice here, but she's not just dependent on the Southern Baptist Convention.
Yeah, it definitely seems like if her books are like the most popular selling books for Lifeway, then obviously they've kind of just transcended just this one particular denomination. And I don't even know how much I was aware of Southern Baptists even when I was doing her Bible study books.
Yeah. She also publishes with Tyndale, you know, which is a more, I believe, non-denominational publisher. And if that gives you a sense of, she's sort of non-denominational too in her outreach, I guess.
You talked about her being really personable. I just, for people who aren't viewing her on Twitter, I think it's also pretty rare for someone that has nearly 1 million followers to be as personable with the people that follow her and as engaged in having conversations with people as she is.
Yeah, I think in some ways, you know, it's easy to build a personality and a following on social media, but that it's not just she, you know, started a Twitter account and accumulated these followers. She's had a huge following for decades now. Like this isn't an overnight thing. And so, you know, when she speaks with this to women who have been following her for decades. And I think that's partly, you know, why this is all interesting is that she fairly later-ish in her career is having this sort of moment of reckoning.
Yeah, I think right now you're just hinting at this. I guess if we're going to sign off, you know, like you're talking to a traditional reporter, what's next? What are the storylines that we should follow, I guess, when it comes to Beth Moore?
Yeah, like I said, I think I'll be watching to see if she speaks more on racial reconciliation and next year with the 2020 election, you know, is she going to play some kind of role in swaying evangelical opinion? I don't know. Like, does she have that kind of sway? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I'll be watching.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for giving us this overview of Beth Moore and also what's going on right now with the Southern Baptist Convention and sex abuse. We really appreciate it. People who want to give us feedback can do so. We're at podcast@christianitytoday.com. You can also find us on Twitter @CTPodcasts. I just wanted to take the time to remind everyone that this podcast is made possible by everyone who supports our ministry. And Mark is currently doing this thing that comes out on Wednesdays, which is also the day that the podcast comes out, called Elusive Presence. He is not referring to him. Who are you referring to? I don't actually know who
you're referring. The Elusive Presence is God, the Holy Spirit.
Is God eluding us?
No, it means he is difficult to grab a hold of.
Okay.
He's always just beyond our grasp.
Okay.
Yeah.
So but
the title of the series, the title of the series comes from a book of that title.
Okay.
Which is written a few decades ago now. And I read it at the time, and I will have to admit, I don't remember a lot from the book, except the title captivated me and has so ever since. But in the last, 5 to 10 years, it occurred to me that I was able to lead a very successful life as a Christian editor, as a
professional Christian.
Christian. And that I probably could do it pretty well without praying mm-hmm. and without having a deep and passionate love for God. But I noticed when I read the Psalms and various portions of Scripture and some of the saints I most admired, they were deeply passionate about finding God, knowing God, loving God,
whose presence, as the title of the series suggests, is always just a little bit beyond our grasp, so that we keep yearning for it, if we're on that journey. So it occurred to me that this was something I needed to attend to, but it wasn't just me. I noticed that as I talked with friends and observed, especially our movement, which is supposed to be a movement about loving Jesus and following Jesus, in my opinion, we've forgotten how to do that, how to pursue Christ for who he is in and of himself. So this is a series that's exploring that, both in terms of the signs that I think it's a problem, but also as the series moves on, some ways to move forward.
So one way to look at Mark's series is that this could be a summer discipleship series, I think.
That's true, because I will have published most of the pieces in the initial phase by the end of summer. It will come out as a book by Tyndale in the spring, in which I'll be adding more stuff that won't be in the series. But I'll probably continue this series, because every week as I read and observe and think about and pray, I think, that would be good in the book. But in the meantime, I'll just put it in the in the series. Yeah.
The cool thing about Mark is that he's not worried about offending you, which is something that sometimes the people that we would hope would want to disciple us actually do care about offending us. But thankfully, Mark is not that person, which
but
I think
it is not my intention to.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to say you're trying. I'm just saying, like, you're okay kind of like poking us. And I've like felt poked when I've read through the series.
Okay, good. Well,
which I think is the point.
And I try at various points to note how that poking also works back at me as
sure.
well. Yeah.
Sure.
This is an us problem. This is not I'm the prophet on standing on top of the mountain telling other people what they should do. I'm standing in the valley with the rest of us saying, hey, have we thought about this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. No, I'm not. No, this is not subscription to self-righteousness if you support this. Anyway, I think you should check it out. We publish Mark's series on Wednesdays. So again, it's the same day the podcast comes out. Just head over to our homepage and you'll be able to find that as well as all the previous ones that you may not have seen yet. All right, so now is the time of the show that we call Precious Moments, and it's a great time for everyone to get to share something that has brought them joy recently. Sarah?
So ahead of my trip, I told my three-year-old that I was going to Alabama, and she asked me where that was, and I explained, and she and I said, I'm going to get you a present while I'm there, and she asked me, can you get me a toothbrush? And I told her I would ask people in Alabama if they have toothbrushes.
Oh, gosh.
What does that tell us about your daughter, that she wanted a toothbrush?
I mean, the littlest things excite her, which is so precious. I love it.
What else has she been really excited about lately?
Birthdays and summer. Every day she asks me, is it summer? And I keep telling her yes, even though I'm not sure the equinox has passed or whatever.
That's awesome, though. I love that. Where can people find you, Sarah, outside of this podcast?
Oh, I'm on Twitter. If we're speaking of Twitter, at S-Pulliam, S-P-U-L-L-I-A-M.
Mm-hmm.
I am at thewashingtonpost.com. If you just search religion or search me on Google, you'll find me.
You guys also have a newsletter too, right? That comes out?
We do. Yeah. It's called Acts of Faith. It comes out on Tuesday and Thursdays.
Are you ready, Mark?
I'm ready. Just spent the weekend in New Orleans with grandchild and daughter and son-in-law. And on the way back this morning, in fact, we were driving down a major thoroughfare in the Chicagoland area, western suburbs, called Roosevelt Avenue. Some people say it's Roosevelt, but I remember on my very first trip here when I was interviewing for the job of associate editor at Leadership, how depressing that street was. It was just ugly. And yet that's the street that I ended up driving down, trying to get to a place in Wheaton and Carroll Stream where I was spending the night. And this time when I was driving down, I noticed how pleasant it was. That is to say, the city fathers and mothers had, over the last 15, 20 years, had planted trees and made the sidewalks wider and added nice lamp posts. And I, for the moment, just thought, I'm grateful that there are people in the world that want to try to beautify places where we live. So that was...
Beautification efforts, a little, well, actually, I would not say a little bit goes a long way. A lot goes a long way.
Exactly, yeah.
It really makes a difference.
Yeah.
And you just even like feel different when you're on the road somehow. That road is really interesting because it also runs all the way back to Chicago as well.
Right into town. Exactly.
In fact, it takes you all the way to the planetarium if you so desire.
Now, it isn't so pleasant all the way along, but at least in our end of it, it's pretty nice now. Yeah.
All right. So where can people find you opining outside of this?
Oh, yeah. I publish something called The Galley Report. It can be found at christianitytoday.com/The Galley Report. That's G-A-L-L-I. I comment on various things that are happening, often commenting on what other people are commenting on.
And pretty much.
That's the way the world works nowadays. You don't actually have to produce anything. You just comment on what other people comment on. But at any rate, for some reason, some 20,000 subscribers think it's pretty good, and I appreciate their support. And you might find it that way as well. So check it out.
Okay, speaking of beauty in the world, my precious moment is that I went to Savannah this past weekend. Have you been there, Mark?
I haven't been to Savannah, I don't believe.
So Savannah apparently has a complicated history. From what I understand, much of the South was decimated during Sherman's March to the Sea, which was basically this like really brutal campaign where a lot of the South was just kind of like destroyed. The infrastructure
leveled.
Was just leveled during the end of the Civil War done by General Sherman. And so the friends that I saw when I was in Savannah actually told me that part of the reason Savannah seems to be like so uniquely beautiful is that apparently Savannah was saved because Sherman fell in love with a woman who lived there.
Oh.
He fell in love with the enemy.
Love solves a lot of problems, that's for sure.
And she convinced him, apparently, to not burn down her city. It is super interesting there. The congregation, I don't think the actual church building, but the congregation that John Wesley was apparently a part of, where love actually played a role in this. Okay, correct me if I'm wrong. You're the church historian. But this is what I learned. John Wesley was at this church. He ran into his old beloved that he had hoped to marry and found out that she'd gotten married to someone else. And so he denied her communion. And then he got kicked out of the church, obviously. And he went sulking back to England and then ultimately started Methodism after that. So I was like, wow, this is great. The broken heart that spawned a denomination.
Okay, we haven't had a chance to fact check that. It's an awfully good story, though.
It's really good, right?
Yeah.
So that may be true. But in any event, the church that he was at before he ended up starting what is now known as Methodism is also in Savannah. And Savannah is full of all these extremely beautiful squares that are just throughout the city that have nice trees and some have fountains and statues. And it's just an incredibly lush and green place. In fact, it feels very similar to where Mark was in New Orleans in terms of like being kind of a cousin city to that, though it's a little bit smaller.
We should clarify, he was a founder of a movement that was deridingly called Methodism. And I don't think it became a denomination until after the American Revolution. And then it became a real denomination.
That is information you can actually believe. Someone can tell us if that story about John Wesley's broken heart is true, though.
Yeah. In the meantime, let it entertain you.
All right. People can find me on Twitter. I'm at MEPAYNL. That is it for us this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of Quick to Listen. You can support this podcast by doing lots of things. You can subscribe to the show via any of the places that you get podcasts. We are on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher and Spotify and so forth. So just go ahead and look there. You can also go on the Apple Podcasts and you can rate and review the show, which is a huge way that helps us. Actually, a lot of the information that's from Apple Podcasts goes into then feed these other podcast outlets. So that's kind of the way that it ends up helping us there. You can also become a subscriber of Christianity Today magazine, and that's available at orderct.com/podcasts, orderct.com/podcasts. And yes, this podcast is produced by myself and Cray Allred. The music is by Sweeps. We will see you all next week.